Okay, hello everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, editor of Kane's Beverage News Daily. And on the line with us today is Garrett Peck, who wrote a wonderful book, The Prohibition Hangover, which looks at the issues of alcohol stuff both before and after the era of Prohibition. So let's get started here, Garrett, and let's see where we go.
That sounds great.
Welcome, and I hope you are having a wonderful day today.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here, Joel. Thanks for inviting me here to the call.
You're very welcome. And the weather today is much better in Washington, D.C. than it was on December 5th, and you're going to tell us about that in just a moment or two.
Indeed,
but tell us how you came to write this book.
This is a book here which actually started at Christmas 2003. I went to my grandmother's in Scottsdale, Arizona, and bought a bottle of wine. You know, back then you could take wine on the airplane with you. Remember those days?
I do remember those days.
And I was there with my grandmother, my mom, and myself, and opened up this bottle of wine. And my grandmother just had kind of a negative response to this bottle of wine. Like, what are you doing bringing wine to my dinner table? You know, it's like, what are you thinking? You know, it's Christmas and all. I come from a Methodist background, and of course the Methodists were once, you know, key leaders in the temperance movement.
Sure.
So that led me to, you know, kind of think, what happened here? Why did my grandmother's abstinence, how did that not translate over to my mom and to myself? You know, we're both social drinkers. You know, I collect wine, and I drink pretty much everything. So that was like the eureka moment for the book, and where I thought, I need to go explore this question here. And as I got into the research, you know, discovered that no one at all had written anything about what happened to Americans and alcohol after repeal. I mean, there's plenty of books on Prohibition, certainly, and lots of good stuff before Prohibition, but, you know, what happened over these last 76 years, it was just completely uncharted waters, which was kind of cool to get into. So it was nearly a six-year process, and during which I interviewed several hundred people from across the industry and also from people who are opposed to alcohol, to kind of give a good sense of the spectrum around alcohol.
And frankly, Garrett, that surprises me that there had been no history, so to speak, written after Prohibition. That's a very interesting thing, and I did not realize that, and I suspect a lot of other people didn't either. Maybe it's because we're all too busy writing history on the fly, as you will.
Yeah, or maybe just because alcohol has become actually so accepted now by this point. I mean, two-thirds of us drink today.
Right.
So largely the stigma against alcohol has largely faded away.
And that's been very helped along by things like the French Paradox and the cocktail society that we've gone back to.
And the whole trend towards craft everything, you know, craft beer, craft wine, craft cocktails, you know, that people like. People enjoy the experience better of, you know, quality drinks as opposed to just drinking to get drunk.
Right. So what did you learn about Prohibition, though?
Prohibition itself is such a fascinating era. I mean, I'm still, in a lot of ways, even though I've written about this for years, I'm still really flabbergasted about the fact that we changed the Constitution not once but twice to deal with alcohol. You know, the Prohibition itself lasted nearly 14 years, and the country went into it almost willy-nilly. I mean, it's not easy changing the Constitution, but certainly we used the crisis of World War I and all the German lobby and the German brewers were basically just pushed aside because we declared war on Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that led us very quickly into, you know, Prohibition as kind of a wartime measure, and without the country really thinking this thing out or thinking it through. And pretty quickly the country realized it was a mistake. In a lot of ways, the movement that had pushed Prohibition on the country was the century-long temperance movement, which had tried to get the country to completely abstain from alcohol altogether, and it was their initiative to get the 18th Amendment passed. In a lot of ways, though, I think they were really naive to believe that Americans would simply stop drinking, you know, and that the country would dry up, because alcohol has been actually so fundamental to our culture since the beginning of the colonies. I mean, you know, 400 plus years ago.
And it was also fundamental to the culture of the countries from which we came. I mean, I know that England, for instance, was not exactly the most sober spot, to say nothing of most of the European countries, France, Italy, and so on.
Indeed, yeah. But we have our own culture here in the United States, and in particular, we have these evangelical Protestant churches, and this was their issue. This was,
right.
It was the Methodists, of which I'm one, and the Baptists, and the Congregationalists and a few other churches kind of banded together, and this was their issue that they really pushed upon the country for a century.
Do you think this was partially because was a reaction, talking about the Congregationalists, for instance, talking about thinking about you know, back in the pre-Civil War days when rum was the product that was brought in? Do you think it was all sort of tied into the anti-slavery movement, or do you think that was separate and apart?
I think it was separate and apart from that. Yeah, the movement actually started up in New England, right around Boston, in the early 1800s. I mean, like the first decade.
Mm-hmm.
And by these congregational ministers who saw this heavy binge drinking going on, largely because we'd repealed the whiskey taxes after the whiskey rebellion in 1794.
Right.
And so whiskey was cheap and it was everywhere. And, men were drinking and they were drinking themselves to death. And, there was a legitimate church-based response to that, just as, a church might today might say, there's homeless on the street. We need to help out with this problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they took it to an extreme by... as opposed to saying, wine has always been an integral part of the Bible, which in fact it is, but instead them deciding, we got to retranslate the Bible. Jesus has to become a teetotaler, just because they were, And there was a lot of revisionism that happened to history. But in the abstinence movement, it basically had been a litmus test to get people to quit drinking altogether, not just to moderate their drinking, but, temperance became abstinence.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you research your book? You said you spent 6 years doing it. That's a long time.
Yeah, although I guess it's all kind of relative. I mean, Julia Child took 10 years for her first book, and so did Michael Cunningham. So yeah, I guess 6 years isn't too bad for a first book,
So you figure with the first book taking only 6 years, you're ahead of the game, huh?
Yeah, I kind of look at it that way. Like the next one won't take this long. I hope.
How's the book doing?
We are on the second printing right now.
Well, that's good.
It's good, yeah. So it's getting some traction, which is nice.
That must mean you've earned your advance. Did you get an advance?
Yeah, I got a small advance. So it was published by Rutgers University Press. And Rutgers, by the way, has the Center of Alcohol Studies.
Right.
Which was founded by E.M. Jelinek, and he's the guy back in the 1940s who came up with the disease theory of alcoholism.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So probably the most important... alcohol studies program in the country at a collegiate level. So this kind of fit in with what they wanted to publish.
Very interesting.
That
means academically I have ties to two institutions with alcohol interest.
Oh, yeah? Did you go to Rutgers?
Well, I didn't go to Rutgers, but my wife worked there.
Okay.
And I lived in New Jersey and paid taxes to support Rutgers for about 25 years, so I'm going to claim honorary status here.
There you go.
Then I went to Indiana, where, of course, the breathalyzer was first developed through funding from the... distilled spirits business, which wanted to end the practice of dial-a-drunk. So,
oh wow!
I did not know that. It's interesting.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. So, once we got through Prohibition, what did you find next? Because this is uncharted territory.
Yeah, I guess what I really looked at in the book was to realize, okay, we've got kind of this, I call it the hangover.
Mm-hmm.
From Prohibition itself, which is, Prohibition ended, 76 years ago, this last December 5th, and yet there's a lot of legacy that comes from Prohibition, stuff that we really can't explain anymore, because the people who gave this to us, have long since passed on.
Right.
I looked at the hangover from Prohibition, which was both on the regulatory side and on the social side. And on the social side is kind of the outdated attitudes that we have towards alcohol or sort of awkward attitudes that we still have in a lot of places that, somehow alcohol still has to be heavily controlled, that somehow in some places in the country that it's still wrong to drink or it's wrong to drink it publicly. And you see that pop up, here and there. And, of course, on the regulatory side, the 21st Amendment gave the states control over alcohol, and hence you have really a hodgepodge regulatory regime in these different states. So a number of states became licensed states. The majority did, 32. And then 18 states became control states. And, so kind of looking at sort of the hodgepodge regulations, even right here in the Mid-Atlantic, and it's like Lucy's sort of scratching her head, why in the state of Pennsylvania do you, if you want to buy beer, wine, or liquor, you have to go to a state, completely, you have to go to a state store. or I live in Virginia, and therefore, if I want to buy distilled spirits, but not beer or wine, just distilled spirits, I have to go to a state store as well. Whereas in the district, which has 500-plus liquor stores, District of Columbia, and yet the liquor stores have to be closed on Sundays, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have other places like Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the few counties in the country where you have to go to a county store to buy alcohol. So, yeah, it's really, a lot of ways, it's kind of bizarre because it's all, much of this stems from 1933, early 1934, when the states had to set up their alcoholic beverage control regimes to decide, okay, how are we going to control demon rum now that prohibition is over?
Sure. Were you able to determine why some states became control states and other states did not?
I think it really varied on the particular culture of that state. The Mid-Atlantic certainly has a big swath of control states, and so does the Northwest. And, of course, the Northwest has a lot of Mormons in it, and the Mid-Atlantic has got a lot of Methodists in it. So I think there's got to be partly a religious response to it, that, you know, churches being politically influential could come back and say, okay, if this thing is legal, we want the state to control it, and that way they'll make sure that people still can't get really great access to it.
Right. Well, we should note that a lot of people believe that religion is culture anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that it's sort of a determinant of culture, which, you know, makes me sound like a right-wing fascist pig talking about the current terrorism issues, but I did not pick that up from that crowd, so, you know, I think you have a point there. I think that some of the religious stuff has permeated that, and up in New York and New Jersey, where I spent a large part of my adult life, of course, we have a heavy German and Italian concentration.
Catholics and Jews who were...
Right.
Yeah.
And
Prohibition was largely targeted at them because it was a means of trying to get those people, you know, as they'd say, under control.
Exactly.
They were immigrants.
Yep. And, you know, so it's an interesting development. So now let's take things on from the end of Prohibition. Can you talk about the rise of the alcohol beverage industry at that point? Did you research into that?
I did, yeah. That was really fascinating to study, just how much Prohibition devastated so much of the industry. I mean, the wine industry was nearly wiped out.
Right.
And didn't really recover until the 1960s, which is really fascinating. You had the beer industry, which was fundamentally changed by Prohibition. The federal government really wanted people, after Prohibition was over, the bootleggers had brought in distilled spirits because it was so much more profitable for them because it's higher concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government wanted the public to shift over towards beer, especially towards 3-2 beer. So they actually lowered the taxes on beer, and hence the World War II generation grew up drinking beer, and it was in fact part of the rations during the war.
Are you telling me that that before Prohibition, the tax on alcohol was the same for all three categories?
It was actually, it was never the same. It's always been different based on the category itself.
Uh-huh.
But at the end of Prohibition, within a month after Prohibition ended, the federal government was absolutely desperate for revenue because the income tax had basically just plummeted. And so they decided to tax alcohol fairly heavily. So they jacked up the distilled spirits and the wine tax rates, but actually cut down the tax rate on beer. And that was rationalized as a means of giving the working man a break.
Sure. And that's an argument still used today by the beer industry every time the issue of taxes comes up, which it does every year.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, no one likes to have taxes raised. I mean, you know.
Now, did you look at how some of these companies that are in existence today survived the Prohibition?
Yeah, I did, yeah. So a number of them, especially at the time were the key three brewers, which were Pabst, Schlitz, and Anheuser-Busch, and of those today, the only one that's a household name today is Anheuser-Busch. But they all had to go into other industries, like making, you know, malt tonic or ice cream. You know, they all had to find new industries to get into, and hence the majority of brewers simply just shut down. And as a result, at the end of Prohibition, you know, there were only, you know, less than 100 brewers left in the country still surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the craft beer revolution took off, really in the 1980s, that we began to have a resurgence in the number of breweries around the country.
Now, did you determine why most brewers just shut down? Were you able to determine why Anheuser, Pabst, and Schlitz kept going and, you know, did anything they could to survive that period?
Yeah, I think it was largely they found new business models to that enabled them to at least hang on by their fingernails. So there were a handful that actually did survive, and those were, like I said, those are the big three all the way to the 1950s.
Have you been out to St. Louis to the AB Brewery?
I have not. No, I toured a number of other breweries, including the what was the Latrobe Brewery, where they made Rolling Rock, and the Sam Adams Brewery as well.
Right. Well, I was out in St. Louis this summer, and did the brewery tour at AB. I just did the public tour, didn't ask for anything special, which I'm sure I could have gotten if I wanted to. But I wanted to see what the public tour was like. And the interesting thing is that the building that is their packaging building today apparently was where they made Bevo, which was a non-alcoholic product back in Prohibition.
Yeah.
That's the building you see if you see pictures of them with the Budweiser sign up on top of the building as versus on the side.
Gotcha.
You know, it's interesting. They talk about that, but they did not stay in the soft drink business too long after Prohibition ended.
Yeah. It was also fascinating looking on my book tour. I went to, the first place I went to was Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
which had a long, lengthy and extensive brewing culture, and Prohibition largely devastated it, and it partially recovered, but by the 1970s it had completely shut down, and part of that was just simply consumer economics. You know, there were dozens of breweries that were there, and yet by the 1970s, the breweries that were left in the country had largely consolidated, and like mm-hmm. the Cincinnati Brewers just couldn't compete on a national level, and especially since so many of these companies were all largely making light lager, and there wasn't much to differentiate any of the products, right? So they eventually all shut down, and Cincinnati nowadays has just a handful of brewers that have started up in the last couple of years, including Sam Adams was made there today. It's kind of ironic.
Yeah, it is ironic. They're made there and in outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania, if I recall correctly.
Indeed, yeah. And they have their I call it the test kitchen up in Boston, up in JP.
Right. But those two breweries were a big step forward for Sam Adams, if I recall correctly, because for a long time they were just strictly doing contract work with other people, and
indeed,
and then they got to the point that they got big enough to be able to have their own operations.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk about the advertising of these products? Did you track that and see how that changed over the years, by any chance?
I did, yeah, and that's actually one of the longest running issue between those who make alcohol and those who want to control alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, at this point, it's largely the public health advocates who would like to put more control on advertising or stop advertising altogether in some cases.
Right.
Versus the winemakers, the distillers, the brewers, you know, who need to be able to advertise their products, just because if you don't advertise, if you don't promote, well, you're not going to sell anything, right?
Exactly.
So the debate really started immediately after Prohibition ended. The distilled spirits companies were kind of in the doghouse because of Prohibition, because of bathtub gin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they recognized that, and therefore they largely agreed not to advertise on the radio, and once TV came about in the 1950s, mm-hmm. they agreed, basically a gentleman's agreement, not to advertise on television. Meanwhile, the brewers were like, okay, yeah, whatever, that doesn't apply to us, we're going to advertise. And you still had the Women's Christian Temperance Union around, you still had the Methodist Board of Temperance, Public Morals, and Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried until the 1950s really to stop beer advertising altogether, which failed. And it wasn't, though, until the 1990s, though, as beer became so popular that the first distiller, and that was Seagram's, by the way, in 1996, finally threw in the towel and said, okay, our market share has shrunk so much, we've got to advertise. And they found a couple cable stations that were willing to take their commercials. And since then, they've been advertising more and more, especially on cable stations. A couple of network television stations will take distilled spirits advertisements now. But yeah, it's really interesting to see. This has been, you know, at least a 76-year-long issue, and I think it'll be one of those recurring issues that will just keep going and going and going. You know, because it's kind of a tug of war between these two different camps.
Well, I think it is. I think it will be too, because I know that, you know, about every 3 years the anti-alcohol advocates file petitions with the FTC to look at how much advertising they're doing and whether they're really staying within their own self-prescribed guidelines and so on and so forth. So I suspect that you'll find, you know, if you want to watch advertising for the next 30 or 40 years, Garrett, I'm sure you'll have a ton of stuff to write about there.
Yeah, it might be a little dry, but...
exactly. The trick, of course, would be finding somebody to publish all this ton of stuff the way media outlets are folding, but...
exactly, yeah.
You know, but yes, that's true. How about promotions as different from advertising? Did you, by any chance, take a look at the promotions that the brewers and the distillers were doing or not?
I didn't get so much into that in the book. I do kind of think that probably does fall under the promotion category. Although I do say it is kind of interesting to see state by state. And again, I live in Virginia, and we're a control state. And part of one of the things that we control is we are unable to advertise happy hour or promotions.
Oh, really?
Which is really interesting. You cannot, if you have a bar, you cannot advertise happy hour. Legally, there's no such thing here in Virginia. and yet, of course, we all go to happy hour, right?
You know? I was going to say, so what do?
We go anyways, right? But you're not allowed to advertise for it. The state
Does that mean you can't put a sign outside your bar, happy hour 4 to 6?
Correct. Correct, yeah. In fact, in Virginia, technically, there are no such things as bars.
Uh-huh.
Because
what are they?
Food, yeah. Again, that kind of goes back to the end of Prohibition, where they didn't want to allow bars and saloons in the state again. And therefore, you can only have a restaurant, where there might be a bar attached to it, right? But so a certain amount, this becomes obfuscation, right? Because, you know, we all go to bars, and, okay, they're serving hot dogs and chips.
Right.
But we're really there to go drink, you know.
That sounds like Virginia is the place I should go if I want to have my little pigs in a blanket, which I love so much.
Yeah.
Of course, my middle doesn't want them, and my doctor doesn't want me to have them. But
yeah, probably best to avoid, you know.
Yeah. So bring us up a little bit now, forward into the book. You talked about the 40s, but didn't the 40s see a change in the industry a bit? I mean, it started to get a little bit larger companies and so on.
I'd say the real big shift probably came after World War II. During the war itself, distilled spirits were heavily cut back, especially, for example, the bourbon industry. They were asked for the war effort to make industrial solvents.
Mm-hmm.
And that was needed to clean battleship guns and so on, and they had the technology to do that. So
Right. Whiskey
came in very, very short supply. And that wasn't any kind of, there was no temperance reasoning behind that. It was simply, look, you've got a skill set, we need these solvents, so please make this for us.
Right.
And hence, if you wanted distilled spirits during World War II, what was important was rum, because they came out of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And hence, by the 1950s, we had this whole tiki culture thing going on, you know. And there was kind of a cocktail resurgence in the 1950s as, you know, the three martini lunch came about and
right.
so on. And have you had a chance to watch Mad Men?
Mad Men?
Yeah,
no,
Mad Men.
No, no.
Yeah.
What is it, a TV show?
Yeah, it's on Bravo, and it's brilliant. It's set about 1960 or so, and it's heavy drinking in the office and smoking. And it's a really brilliant show. It's sort of, I think it kind of has replaced The Sopranos, you know, in the cultural lexicon now.
And what's the name of the program again?
Mad Men.
Mad Men.
Yeah, and it's about Madison Avenue.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I can relate to the smoking in the office. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
You know, because that was definitely at the Wall Street Journal when I started there in 1968.
Wow.
So, you know, that was part of the culture. And three martini lunches, of course, were notorious up until what, the 70s?
Until Jimmy Carter took away the tax deduction.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that sort of wrecked that game.
Yeah. Indeed,
so
and it's kind of interesting to see today, unless you work directly for an alcoholic beverage company, but if you work in technology or, you know, any other field, it's generally frowned upon to have alcohol now at lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that Sam Adams commercial a number of years ago where these guys were all like, I'll take an iced tea, and then one guy says, I'll take a Sam Adams, and then the rest of the guys are like, me too. Remember that commercial?
Right.
And they were sort of kind of poking fun at this culture of, gosh, are we allowed to have a beer at lunch, you know? Because it's still, I think, kind of awkward and perhaps socially unacceptable in a lot of places to do so.
Well, I think it is. I know I go to a meeting down at the National Press Club once a month, and actually twice a month for this particular thing. And I think, I swear I'm the only person that ever has anything other than water or iced tea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may, of course, indicate that everybody's too poverty-stricken in the media business nowadays to be able to afford anything other than water or iced tea, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but people in the media used to be, you know, big drinking culture.
It certainly did. Well, you know, the press club had liquor license number one in the district after Prohibition.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which may tell you where they thought they could make their fastest sales.
Indeed, yeah. And it's funny that where the I was just researching this, where the National Press Club is, was, you know, right where Newspaper Row was,
right,
the Washington Post and all the different bureaus from all the D.C.-based bureaus from all the different newspapers used to be right along there.
Right.
And right around the corner, where right across from the district building, where the District of Columbia's key office building is,
mm-hmm,
there used to be Rum Row. So, like, Shoemakers was there and all these different bars that were legendary for D.C., well, right there, and of course, you know, drinking a newspaper, reporting went hand in hand, right?
Sure. So,
you know, that's where all the lobbyists went, and that's where all the newspapermen went to go get scoops, you know.
And now look at it, it's basically institutional buildings down there.
Yeah, the J.W. Marriott's there, and the National Theater's there, and an office building in between, but nothing quite like Rum Row anymore.
Right. Well, now that brings us to the topic of what you did on, what was it, Saturday, December 5th, which was the 77th anniversary of the end of Prohibition?
Exactly, 76, yeah. We had, that day is, by the way, is called Repeal Day,
mm-hmm,
December 5th, 1933. And on that day, the state of Utah was the state that put the 21st Amendment over the top. And so Repeal Day is measured from December 5th on, which we also colloquially will call it Cinco de Drinco.
Cinco de Drinco, I like that.
Exactly. And here in Washington, D.C., we had a Repeal Day ball that was put on by the D.C. Craft Bartenders Guild, which is led by Derek Brown. And they had that at a restaurant called PS7's. And we got bartenders from around the country. So the guy who actually set up the first Repeal Day website, Jeffy Morgenthaler,
uh-huh,
he is out of Portland. He flew out for the event. We had Dale DeGroff came down and his wife, Jill, who just published a book as well called Lush Life, and which is a whole bunch of really cool drawings of all these different bartenders and kind of humorous. and we had 300-plus people at this ball. So it was,
wow,
just an amazing array of cocktails, all handmade and just really, really, really fabulous.
And where was this ball held?
It was at a restaurant called PS7's in,
uh-huh,
Chinatown in Washington, D.C.
Now, did they actually have dancing there or not?
We actually didn't have dancing, though. Last year we had a different location that had a big ballroom attached to it. But this was, it's more of a restaurant, and so there was a nice big band that was there and stuff, but it was more for, you know, background music and stuff. So.
Sure.
So a lot of good mingling going on and stuff. And
now, the previous year when you were there, you were there obviously last year, too.
Yes, it was.
Did anybody dance, or did everybody just still mingle?
No, actually, we did have dancing as well. So,
uh-huh.
And that was a different place in D.C., the City Tavern Club, which has a very, very large ballroom in it. But all the drinking was all sort of done together with the dancing. And
sure.
So, fortunately, no tables got kicked over or anything. So.
Well, that's a good thing. I mean,
exactly.
Especially with a lot,
yeah,
of people with an interest in alcohol there. I mean,
exactly. So the other thing which we did on actually both years, both this year and last year, was I lead this tour called the Temperance Tour, which is a tour of Prohibition-related sites here throughout the nation's capital.
Mm-hmm.
So we take people to the Cogswell Temperance Fountain and explain, you know, what temperance was, the abstinence movement, and we go up to Calvary Baptist Church, which is actually just one block away from PS7's, where we have the ball.
Uh-huh.
And that was the church where the Anti-Saloon League had its first national convention in 1895.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, it's a beautiful church. It's a bright red brick, polychrome building. And the AOL was a very powerful lobby in its time. They only existed from 1893 to 1933, and they're the ones who gave us the 18th Amendment. And then we finished
up
the tour.
Thanks a lot, right?
What's that, sir?
Thanks a lot, right?
Yeah. And then we end up the tour at the Woodrow Wilson House. He's the only president who retired to Washington, D.C., and he was the president when Prohibition went in effect. And an interesting story, there's a wine cellar in the house. Prohibition, of course, was in effect when he left the White House, so he had to get a special law passed from Congress to transport his wine cellar out of the White House over to his new house. a couple miles away. He didn't want to leave it behind for Warren Harding, the new president. Harding was a known heavy drinker. So.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. So, and also considered to be the most corrupt president in American history.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating to see this old wine cellar that's still there, and it still has a lot of bottles from that time, including there's a bottle of Cointreau that's in there that they have not changed the packaging hardly at all. It's really, really fascinating to see this old thing.
Fascinating. Now, what put you on to doing this book?
Again, that was the story at my grandmother's place when I brought that bottle of wine.
That's right. You told us that, didn't you? Yeah. I forgot that because I'm sitting here. We're just sort of chatting, and I forgot that we started out with that issue, but
yeah.
Went back to your grandmother's place.
Exactly, yeah.
What gave you the intensity to continue the book up to 6 years is a long time, Garrett.
It is, yeah. I'm like a bulldog with a bone.
Uh-huh.
So it gives me an idea in my head, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to keep doing this until I get it done.
Good.
So went through a lot of different hoops and stuff. The research and writing went fairly quickly, and then just trying to find a publisher, especially if you're a first-time author. That's
good.
The hard thing, because they're all, okay, who are you, and, you know, why are you qualified? Unless you're a big public figure like Sarah Palin or, you know, Barack Obama, the rest of us kind of have to struggle and, you know, prove, okay, I'm actually... know what I'm talking about here. I'm a subject matter expert, and so hence I ended up, you know, doing a lot of freelance work here for the industry and developing the temperance tour and so on.
Right.
And
so,
I think it was a very good 6-year process, and you know, I'm extremely happy with the publisher with Rutgers. Just the quality control that went into the book. I couldn't ask for a better book, I think.
You gonna do another book for him?
I got a couple other book ideas. It's probably starting in. Probably in early 2010, I'll start working on my next ideas, I think. So we're through this month, I'm still, you know, heavy into the promotion right now of this book.
Sure, and how is the promotion going?
It's going well. We've been, since the book came out September 1st, and then spent basically 2 months traveling, and then I came back home to D.C. and been doing just a ton of events here locally, and wow, promotion feels like a 7x24 job, so it's a lot of fun. And just, you know, reaching different audiences and so on, and, you know, coming across some very, very humorous stories. You know, a lot of cases, you know, just doing the promotion feels like throwing spaghetti at the wall. So you have a couple events where, gosh, 4 people show up, and then you have other events. Like I had this big cocktail party we had up in Eastern Standard, a really good cocktail bar up in Boston,
mm-hmm.
where we had 425 people showed up, like, oh my gosh, you know, we got great press for it, and, you know, they turned the evening into a speakeasy.
Sure.
And it was really, really fun. So, yeah, it's just sort of the whole trial and error promotion and, you know, realizing, you know, it doesn't hurt to fail. You know, you can just, okay, something didn't work, you know, well, all right, talk it up to experience and try something else.
Let
you know.
Go on, right?
Exactly, yeah. And if you, I gave a talk at Google, at the Googleplex in Mountain View.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, one of their corporate mottos is, you know, if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. You
that
know,
sounds
like,
good.
Yeah, sort of, you know, yeah, you need to be willing to try, and, you know,
and
not every idea is going to work. You know.
Your talk was about the book?
It was, indeed, yeah. And that's actually up on Google itself, and it had up on YouTube. And I've had a couple of the recordings as well. There's a really cool one by Reason TV. It's a little 8-minute explanation of the book with some really cool graphics and old-time photos and stuff. And it's pretty neat.
And that's also on YouTube?
It is indeed, yeah, and up on the Reason TV website. But, yeah, if you just go to YouTube and, you know, look up Garrett Peck or Prohibition
right.
Hangover, it'll come right up.
And that'll pop it right up.
Indeed.
So now, what is your assessment, as I have little notes popping up all over my screen now, what is your assessment of the industry today?
I think the industry is... because of the, as we're calling it, the Great Recession, is in the midst, I think, of what I would call a seismic shift. And that's largely leading to, you know, consumers dramatically shifting their drinking habits, both what they drink and where they drink. Now, the key thing to remember is that Americans are still drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans have not slowed down their drinking. They have not cut off drinking. During the worst part of the recession, of course, everybody stayed home. Right, so it really shifted away from on-prem to off-prem, and that was that really hurt a lot of restaurants and a lot of liquor stores and so on. And I think consumers are starting to come back. I think the recession's over. That said, it's going to be a very, very, very slow recovery. But because of the recession, so many people have really taken another look at what value means. And as a result, they're largely trading, consumers are largely trading back down. And, of course, anytime there's a seismic shift like this, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers.
Sure.
Anybody who was selling $60 bottles of vodka is probably hurting right now, right? Because consumers are suddenly saying, maybe that $16 bottle of Smirnoff would just suit me just fine, right? Do I need to spend the $60, you know? You know, champagne has certainly suffered quite a bit because, well, it got to above $50 a bottle, and, you know, a lot of people are now balking at that when there's alternatives like Prosecco and so on.
Right.
So
I saw something today, I think, that indicated champagne sales were down 50% or something,
yeah,
which is an astounding number. I'm not going to say that that's correct. But
yeah. So there's certainly been some winners throughout this, some surprise brands like Pabst Blue Ribbon. I'm seeing that pop up now like at Whole Foods.
Right.
And they're kind of, you know, taking on the whole retro, cool, hey, it's cheap kind of thing. And certainly a lot of craft beer is benefiting as well because you have a lot of wine drinkers who are like, okay, spending all this money on a bottle of wine, ooh, it's getting a little expensive here, but I can get a really good, you know, six-pack of good beer now for $9.99.
Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's some terrific books out on the beer side about the flavor profiles and so on, which may be helping that also.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking with Rebecca Spicer from NBWA today, and she said there are 13,000 beer labels in the United States, which I found to be a really high, surprising number. But with that many labels, you know, you're bound to have some varieties and tastes that will appeal to different people.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah. So, I think for people who are on the call who work in the industry, you know, take heart. Americans are still drinking, and they will still continue to drink. But just realize that we've had this huge earthquake, and that we really have to adapt to the new market, and that consumers are much more likely to second-guess their purchases now,
right.
including, you know, the $200 bottle service that they would have purchased, you know, 2 years ago that they're now going to go. You know what? That's a lot of money to spend on this. Let's rethink this, right?
Now,
so, yeah, there's been this whole reassessment of what value means.
Sure. Now, in talking to your bartender friends, and I gather you do because of your affiliation there with the D.C., what is it, Craft Bartender Guild?
Exactly.
What are they telling you?
They seem to be doing fairly well. They have a bit of a niche culture, and D.C. has held up fairly well here in the recession.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, especially if you go out like 14th Street and, you know, some hip neighborhoods, you see people out and about, and you're like, wow, what recession? I mean, everybody's out drinking and eating,
sure,
you know, still. And yet, if you look a little bit closer, people might be only having one drink as opposed to two. You know, they're still drinking, but they're cutting back, you know.
But they're cutting back, they're cutting back and they're lowering their price points.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I think bars that have been good about responding to that desire have been able to do okay.
And what have they done to respond to that desire?
I think the $16 cocktail just got too expensive,
mm-hmm,
you know. So being able to bring the price point down might, in fact, mean you might get more sales.
Sure.
Doesn't mean you have to necessarily, you know, cinch on the quality or anything. Just, you know, there is, in fact, a good profit margin in a lot of these cocktails.
Okay.
But there's a lot of things that you can do, and a lot of restaurants especially have been able to figure out, you know what, if we can come up with a package of like, a tasting menu together, as opposed to having it $75, if we can bring it down to, say, $35, we'll get a lot more people to actually come into the restaurant and try it, you know, and so on. So there are ways to get the consumer to come in. If you can appeal to their value side, you know, the idea that, hey, I'm going to get something I'm really going to enjoy, and it's not going to break my bank.
Mm-hmm. And are you also finding that there is still an interest in exploring new tastes, new things, which there had been for a while, or has that sort of gone away?
No, absolutely. I think that still continues. You know, if you went to a farmer's market at all during the recession, you saw they were more crowded than ever. Because people are, you know, like, well, I'm going to cut back a bit here, so let me go make my own food now, you know. And, you know, Americans are really big into this whole foodie thing. You know, if you watch TV, there's a gazillion food-related shows. And
yeah,
I think the whole craft phenomenon kind of dovetails into that, the fact that Americans are more interested in the quality of their drinks and the quality of their food. And, you know, they like the idea of having fresh ingredients. And now finally, you know, over the last 10 years or so, and, you know, in part thanks to Dale DeGroff and other, you know, cocktailians who've gotten into the education side, there's a whole cadre of bartenders now who understand, who have largely kitchen-based skills now. They know how to, you know, make drinks that are based on fresh ingredients, as opposed to the old cocktail mixes and so on.
Anything else that we need to talk about here, Garrett, before we open to the call to see if anybody has any questions for you?
I guess I would finally just conclude. I guess the key takeaways here from the Prohibition hangover itself is to, you know, just realize how, I think ultimately how fundamental alcohol actually is to American culture, that it's really largely been there since the very first colonies from, you know, from Jamestown and Plymouth. You know, the Puritans, in fact, did drink, so blaming Prohibition on them isn't exactly fair.
Well put.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, I think it was really naive for the temperance movement, the century-long temperance movement, to believe that the country would simply just dry up just because they changed the Constitution. Just because they changed the law of the land doesn't mean that Americans were willing to stop drinking, ultimately. And so looking at alcohol in American society, I think, you know, two-thirds of us today drink alcohol. Not everybody can drink alcohol, nor should everybody drink. There are some people with a family history and so on who should definitely stay away from it. But I think as Americans become mature about alcohol, I'm hoping certainly we become more like a lot of European countries, like the Germans and the French and the Italians, where it becomes more of a normal consumer product and you don't have to make such a big deal about it. And hopefully, as well, we can get beyond the era of binge drinking, you know, particularly like for college students and so on, that's going on right now.
Right. Well, there was good news out today from the Monitoring of the Future survey, which looks at high school students, and it found that binge drinking among high school students is down, as is overall alcohol use by that particular age segment, where it's illegal anyway. But for a while, that had been an area of great concern to both health advocates and to the industry itself. And so the Monitoring of the Future survey from the University of Michigan out today shows that both those areas are down. What's up is pot smoking.
So. Yeah, I think there's probably more people coming out now as pot smokers than ever were before, and you know, that all kind of gets involved in the whole medical marijuana issue and so on that we're currently debating.
Exactly. So that's very good. Well, let's open this to the call and see if anybody has any questions, and we'll do that for a moment or two here, and if anybody does, please just speak right up, and Garrett will be happy to take your questions.
Indeed.
And we'll wait a moment here and see if we get any responses. Sometimes people on these calls do such a good job, there are no responses. No questions. So
we'll be glad to take any questions you guys have.
Don't be disheartened there. No, it looks like that's about it, I think, because nobody jumped right in.
Okay.
And we're vamping here. So, Garrett, I want to thank you very much. Your book, The Prohibition Hangover, is a terrific read.
Well, thanks so much.
It's well worth people taking a look at. We'll have it up on our website either tonight or tomorrow morning. It's a free access to the recording. And I'm going to tip off a friend of mine by the name of Roger C. Parker, who is a guy who's a book counselor about you, and he may want to do a separate interview looking largely at the process through which you did the writing and so on. So I'll let
cool.
him know about this.
Yeah, I'd love to.
And invite him to listen to the recording.
Cool, cool. And if I can make a final plug here, I have a website as well.
Okay.
Which is www.prohibitionhangover.com. All one word, yeah. Prohibitionhangover.com.
Okay.
So if anybody would like to contact me, there's a contact me feature on there, and I'll be glad to take any questions. So and I'm very available. So yeah, hit me up. And I've got a lot of other stuff up there on the website about the book and book overview and that kind of stuff. So I'll be glad to help people out.
Well, that's terrific. And again, thank you for your time, and thanks to everybody on the call and those who will be listening to the recording in the future. And we'll see you all soon again.
Great. Thanks again, Joel. And thanks to everybody here who attended the call here tonight.
Thanks, Garrett.
All right. I pressed one.
And
I did, too.
Everybody,
I'm ready. I'm agreeable.
Okay. So, Mark, go ahead and say hello to Garrett Peck.
Garrett, thanks for calling back.
Oh, you're welcome, Mark.
Really a pleasure to talk to you. I'm calling from Indiana, oftentimes the epicenter of alcohol deregulation, thanks to Professor Alex Tanford at Indiana University. My question is, we're 75 years past the end of Prohibition and the beginning of the regulation of alcohol, and yet we seem to be at a crossroads where there's a tremendous push to deregulate this product. And my concern is that many people who were born well after Prohibition and well after the beginning of the regulation of this product don't understand why we do things the way we do. And I guess my question to you is, what would you say to people who are hell-bent to regulate this product? To deregulate this product.
I think it all kind of depends on where the deregulation is coming from. I live in Virginia, and one of the things we're talking about now is privatizing the ABC stores. We have to go to a state-run store to buy distilled spirits, and so there's a discussion about right now about possibly privatizing those. And yet, I think the regulation will still be in place. If Virginia is a controlled state, and in that case, it would probably shift over to becoming a licensed jurisdiction. So it would enact the three-tier system. I think the three-tier system works fairly well in this country. We've had it now for 75-plus years, and I don't think there's really been any kind of effective challenge to that. There was a case that, you know, Costco case.
And Granholm.
There was Granholm, yeah, although that is a tiny, tiny part of the market itself. That's, you know, consumers who want to have wine shipped to them, which is estimated to be about 3% of the overall wine market. So it's a very, very small part of the market itself.
So, well, we're here in Indiana with Professor Tanford and others who are suggesting that this product should be sold as easily as possible. It should be sold over the internet. It should be delivered by UPS. It simply is not that big of a deal. It can be the age verification can be done by third party age verifiers. I mean, it just seems to me that there's a group of people out there led by wine collectors, led by retailers, who would like to see this product sold as easily as possible, and I just can't imagine that that's going to be a good idea for the general public over the long haul. It's just almost as if we have done a terrible job in our industry of explaining to people why we regulate alcohol the way we do.
Yeah, it's going to always be, I think there's a, you know, in any market-based economy, you're always going to have different camps and different business interests. In this case here, you have largely small wineries who want to be able to get access, and they can't always get a wholesaler to represent them. You know, part of the problem, of course, is the wholesalers have consolidated so much over the last decade or so. And so if you're a small winery that only produces a few thousand cases each year, you might not be represented. You might not be distributed. And so, yeah, so the whole, you know, wine to market, direct to consumer, ship to consumer, has become an outlet for them to get to market. You know, again, it's like somebody trying to build a better mousetrap just so that they can, you know, they can find a new way of getting business in. So I think there will always be challenges to that. At the same time, I don't want to overstate, you know, wine direct to consumer is always going to be a tiny niche. You know, any kind of alcoholic product, obviously, it's liquid and it's expensive to ship, right? So the idea.
Well, it gets cheaper the more concentrated it becomes. So the problem that we have after Granholm is that if you allow retailers to ship wine, before long, the argument could be made that retailers can ship Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it becomes pretty efficient to ship Jack Daniels direct to consumer, if that's where this ends up as we go down this slippery slope. And I think that's where Tanford is headed. I mean, Tanford doesn't see any difference between shipping beer or shipping wine or shipping Jack Daniels. To him, it's just a commerce issue, and it's not a 21st Amendment, or it's not a three-tiered issue. And in his mind, it's not even a protecting the underage consumer or the abuser of alcohol from the product, because in his mind, third-party verification or the UPS driver can do just as good a job as checking the consumer for age or intoxication before delivery as the clerk at your local liquor store, which I find completely absurd.
Yeah, I think ultimately the issue, I totally understand your concern here around this. At the same time, I don't want to really overstate the economic impact of all of this, because I think it's certainly more than trivial, and yet it's always going to be a niche market. You know, at this point, I haven't heard a common call, you know, probably beyond that one professor, calling for deregulation of the market entirely. I don't think most people are actually comfortable with the idea of, gee, let's us have everything shipped to our homes, you know. And there's not been any kind of national movement for that yet. So the wine thing seems at this point here to be an exception. And remember, you know, Granholm versus Held was already decided 4.5 years ago, and nothing else has really dramatically come out of that. Nor have there been any kind of dramatic changes. You know, a few more states have allowed direct to consumer shipments, but it's still a very small part of the marketplace. At this point, I'd still be far more concerned about the, you know, ultimately consumer shift in which products that they're buying at bars or on-premise locations or off-premise and so on. That's probably a far more economic impact to most business owners, I think, than wine direct-to-consumer probably ever will be.
Yeah, I think that retailer to consumer in the more concentrated distilled spirits is where we lose at the end of the ball game. And so, to me, trying to protect the three-tiered system at every step along the way is an attempt to try and prevent getting to that end game where retailers are shipping distilled spirits direct to consumer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And have you seen an attempt at that, Mark, of any significance thus far?
Tanford has been quoted as saying that he will continue to sue until he reaches that point.
Okay.
You know, and he was involved in Granholm, and I don't think he was not involved in Costco,
no,
but he's been involved in many suits around the country on the direct shipment of wine, but has been quoted as saying that we will continue to sue until retailers as well as suppliers and wineries can ship direct to consumer. And when you can buy Jack Daniels over the internet, the game is pretty much over.
Yep. That sounds right. The question I really wonder about is you know, the shipment direct to retailers, that retailer to retailer, which I know some people have been trying to do. Am I right about that?
Well, it's possible. I mean, under Granholm, you know, you get into a situation where if you allow something, I mean, we have a situation in Indiana right now where we have a retailer who is shipping wine direct via UPS throughout Indiana, with the argument that we allow our retailers, our liquor stores in Indiana, to ship to a consumer's home. However, they have to do it with a licensed clerk. One of their employees can deliver to one of their customers at the customer's home. They've argued, and they are arguing with Tanford's help, that since we allow our in-state wineries and out-of-state wineries, for that matter, who have a direct shipper's permit, and the consumer has completed a face-to-face transaction at the winery, face-to-face transaction at the winery, from that point on, they can ship direct to the consumer's home in limited quantities. Now, this liquor store is arguing that it's not fair to allow wineries with a direct shipper's permit to use a common carrier to ship all over Indiana if we don't allow retailers to use a common carrier to direct ship all over Indiana. The problem is that based on Granholm, if you allow an Indiana retailer to use a common carrier to direct ship all over Indiana, then you have to allow retailers from all over the country to use a common carrier to direct ship all over Indiana. So, I mean, Granholm has huge implications if you allow a permittee in your state to do something that you don't allow anybody else to do. And Tanford is involved in this, arguing that this retailer should be allowed to do this because we allow the wineries to do it. And the problem is, if we allow this retailer to do it, we have to allow all retailers to do it. And so you fight these things, even though it doesn't seem like, I mean, I realize that it's not a huge percentage of the business currently. You fight these because of the next step, or the next two steps, or the next three steps, because you know where this is headed. Professor Steve Diamond famously said to me once, you know, commerce never sleeps. I mean, it never ends. I mean, you know, it never ends.
Right.
And the free enterprise system never sleeps. It never quits. You know, it always wants more. And the problem is that when you're dealing with alcohol, always wanting more, always wanting to be able to sell it easier to more people, I think automatically means that it ends up in the hands then of more underage consumers and more problem consumers, and we end up over time with the same scenario that set us up for prohibition, and that is the unabashed sale of alcohol, which is not good.
Garrett, I think you have a second edition in the works now.
Yeah. They've bitten off an awful lot here with the first edition itself, but it has been interesting to see how a lot of the states have responded to Granholm in particular. And I think with the Costco case, a lot of states really, you know, breathed a huge sigh of relief because it basically upheld the three-tier system. In the Granholm case, a lot of states ended up saying, okay, consumers, direct-to-consumer, that's fine from the winery, but we're going to have to stop here, the retailers, shipping directly to consumers or shipping directly to restaurants. They kind of, you know, split the baby that way, a lot of cases.
Right.
So, because then they realized, okay, gosh, if we can allow a retailer from California to ship to our people, well, you know, incomes, you know, every other retailer who wants to now start shipping into our state, and we have to start licensing those people. So at this point, a lot of states have held simply just to the wineries to allow them to ship, which I think in a lot of cases limits the impact.
I think the reaction to Granholm in each state was a direct result of how strong the wine industry was in that state.
I would agree with that.
And I think that the reaction to Granholm was a direct relationship to the strength of the wine industry in your state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if your wine industry was really strong, then you ended up leveling down, which meant you made it easier then for your in-state wineries and wineries around the country to ship direct to your consumers.
Exactly.
If your wine industry was not that strong, then you leveled up, which made it more difficult for your in-state wineries and wineries around the country to ship to your consumers.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why you have a state like California, which still produces, you know, all 50 states now, including Alaska and Hawaii, produce wine, and yet California still produces 90% of the country's wine. So, you know,
right,
they have everything to gain from free trade, right? They want
right.
to be able to ship to the rest of the
right.
state. Because it's
and the other states, the wineries are basically using California juice. You know, I mean, everybody raises a few grapes in their state, but the truth is that Indiana wineries are bottling California juice,
mm-hmm.
and so you know, it's kind of a joke, really. But we have about after 40 years of development, we have about 400 acres of vineyards in Indiana. which doesn't produce very much wine, and so most of our wine is produced from California grapes and bottled as Indiana wine.
Interesting. I didn't know that, Mark.
Oh.
Sure. Yeah. Huge tankers pull up to Indiana wineries and offload California juice, and that is then produced into Indiana wine, and Indiana is not unique. You know, our climate does not lend itself to a tremendous production of a wide variety of grapes.
Right.
We have about 420 acres of vineyards in Indiana, and this is after 20 or 30 years of trying. And so they make for nice pictures on the brochures, but they don't make for a lot of wine. Most of the wine is made from juice from outside of Indiana, and most of that from California.
Well, that's really interesting to me because, you know, I knew for a while that Oliver Winery did not have its own vineyards, or at least not much of them. But and I guess I sort of knew that, but I thought they were actually, you know, processing the grapes and all, but no, they're just taking tankers of juice and doing it that way, huh?
My guess is that Oliver has more acreage of vineyard than anyone else in Indiana, but it still is less than 100 acres. It's probably closer to 55 or 60. And so they do produce some wines that are made from their grapes, and they're good wines. But the majority of Oliver's wines come from California juice.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I think Garrett and I both have just learned something.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And Indiana is not unique. You know, most of these wineries that are popping up are using juice that they buy from outside their state, and most of those come from the West Coast.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, I ran an item recently about some winery up in, I think it was in Idaho or Montana, and I was really wondering, you know, how they could do significant wine growing up there, but I think you just answered the question.
The stainless steel tankers pull up on a regular basis and offload the juice.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that's the answer to that question.
So, Garrett, have you got any questions for Mark?
I think I'm good here for now.
And
yeah.
Mark, how about you?
I'm good. Glad I called.
Was this worthwhile for you?
You bet.
Good. I will have the first half of this call up on our website probably tonight or tomorrow, and when I do, I'll make sure I send out a link with both parts of this call so everybody can get both halves.
Great.
And Garrett, again, thank you very much, and Mark, thank you for calling in. And this
you
is
bet.
Very interesting exchange, one-on-one between Mark and Garrett, so thanks so much, guys.
Indeed.
Thanks, Garrett.
For calling back.
And, thank you.
Have a terrific day.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.